Yeah, that's right. And I mean, what concerns me is there are a lot of people now, because compost is starting to be, you know, like as a thing. And even by doing the course, if you never go down the track of making your own, you actually can check it, or you know the questions to ask, or you know what to look for by having done that course, that you know you're dealing with someone that you can trust because they know what they're talking about, and you know they're delivering something that is what they say it is. And I think that's a very important point.
Yeah. We encourage all farmers to use soil tests to manage anything that they do, whether it be a chemistry test or a soil food web test. I mean, they're all management tools that farmers can use. And you can validate any progress that the farmer's been making. It can validate whether those inputs are valid. So I think all of those things are really important to do. I mean, microscope courses you can do that, or you can outsource it, of course. Depends on where the farmer's coming from. Yeah. Yeah.
Tony, just getting back to you sending stuff out to farmers, how stable is it? How have you gone to the other end and tested it when it's arrived?
What we do in most instances now, in fact, probably 99.9% of instances, we don't make a compost tea as such, where we brew up and add foods, etc. We make a compost tea extract. Now, the difference between a tea, a brewed tea, and an extract is that with a brewed tea, you put in maybe 10 kilos of compost, and then you'll add foods. And as an example, it might be a bit of fish, it might be a bit of seaweed, might be a bit of sugar, or whatever the different there's different brews or different recipes around. And you'll bubble it. You may add a bit of heat, depending on the system you want to work to. Sometimes you get enough heat from the actual engine of the pump, which will lift the temperature by 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 degrees. And then after a period of time, and that will vary, you can check it on the microscope and look at numbers. And then when you get to a certain level, then spray it out. Now, we started doing that probably 10 years ago, and we found that it was very difficult to get the same formula to give you the same result each time. It was a nightmare, and we weren't comfortable selling a product that wasn't consistent each time. So what we decided was, well, hang on a sec, why put in 10 kilos? We've got 20,000 tons of compost here. We don't have to be miserable about the compost. Why don't we go and put 200 kilos of compost into the container and bubble that, and then we don't have to add any foods? And what we found was that, obviously, it's only as good as the compost that you put in.
Yes.
But when you're not adding foods, you don't lose your dissolved oxygen. And you're extracting the biology that's in that sample. And if you put enough compost in, you actually get the numbers. And, in fact, in our case, we get more than the numbers required to meet a tea standard that the Soil Food Web has set. So we actually work on the premise of making the tea about 10 times stronger than the premise needed to meet Soil Food Web standards. And it's like, well, all we have to do is put a bit more compost in to do that. And then we screen it, obviously. So it's like muddy water, which is being bubbled. We screen it through a 300 micron screen. And then we put it through a silt trap. We can pull out some finer material that can sit in the bottom of a boom spray. And then out it goes. And what we found was, because there's been no foods added, it's very stable. And it actually has a shelf life of 2 or 3 days. So we've never had any problems with that product, because we haven't added any foods to it. And the activity might be a little bit lower because there's no foods in it. But as soon as they mix it with a bit of fish or a bit of something, they usually get a bit of a bacterial bloom at least. And you get your activity comes up a little bit by the time it's gone out. So from our point of view, that's a really good product for soil drenches. Not quite as good for leaf coverage, because you want a bit more activity in there. So to get a bit more activity in there, if it is going on for leaf, we usually add just a little bit of sugar at the last minute, just to lift the activity a little bit. And mainly that's with your bacteria, but just to try and lift the activity at the time of spraying, because it doesn't take long to lift it. Yeah.
That makes sense. It's giving them a food source too while it's going up. Tony,
absolutely.
Just getting back to putting it out, like, we've found that people do have particular nozzle sizes. Are you particular about the sort of nozzles that they're using when they're putting out these sprays?
we're not as specific as some people, and Elaine's always said, always grab a sample out of the nozzle and see whether you've killed the bugs, because you can, it's a bit like hitting your head against a brick wall. If you do that too often, it's not real good for your health. And we haven't got too worried about it. What we have tested, don't get me wrong. We just use a normal firefighting pump with a double impeller, which is a fairly standard type of pump. It's not anything special. We haven't gone for a diaphragm pump. I mean, so I know some people have gone for a diaphragm pump. The nozzles, we're usually looking at a slightly larger nozzle, and it's partly to do with the fact that often the farmers are putting fish out, but it's also because there is a little bit of a silt that can be in the tea. So they can use if they're using tea jets, they can use like a flood jet and block off every second nozzle. And that gives you a reasonable rate and reasonable coverage without necessarily trying to squash the bugs as you pump them through through the nozzle. Yeah. Our view is on that, we aim to get 10 times the numbers that the soil food web promotes as being an adequate tea. So that gives us some scope that if we have killed a few bugs, that we've still got reasonable numbers in that system. And also means that if we add some nitrogen or if we add some fish or whatever we add to it, yes, we might compromise a few of them, but we haven't compromised all of them. So we've still got our volumes in there. And Elaine's talked about this and sort of said, well, you know, if your numbers are up and you do squash a few bugs or you do fry a few bugs in different ways, at least you've still got something going out that might be half reasonable.
Yeah, no, it's a generous allowance. I think that's a very, very good idea. But talking about the sort of additives and bugs too, we also got on to protozoa the other day. Was it protozoa we're talking about for nitrogen, adding that into the mix? Can you just talk a little bit about that? Because people even add commercial microbes and things, don't they?
Absolutely. We look at, well, protozoa basically are a single cell organism that eat bacteria, and they have a different carbon nitrogen ratio than bacteria. So bacteria are around about 5-1 carbon nitrogen ratio. So that's 5 parts carbon, 1 part nitrogen. A protozoa is about 30-1. So 30 parts carbon and 1 part nitrogen. So if they go around and keep eating their bacteria, what happens is they get too many nitrogen parts in their system. So they need to excrete that to manage their carbon nitrogen ratio. That nitrogen that's excreted is plant available nutrients. So that's what we call nutrient cycling. You can actually apply that to any nutrient. You can actually change that and say, well, let's talk about zinc or let's talk about manganese. Different bugs have different concentrations of the different types of nutrients that are found. And by eating each other, they're excreting different nutrients that they don't need. So that's all nutrient cycling, and it's really important to get as much nutrient cycling as you can. So if you do for instance a soil food web test and look at your protozoa numbers and they're low, well, protozoa, if you're looking at flagellates and amoebas, they eat aerobic bacteria. How do we lift our protozoa numbers? Well, there's two ways. One is to put out a spray which has good protozoa numbers. And that can be done through a compost tea, through a worm juice. You can do a protozoa spray as well, where you brew them up, and I might explain that in a minute how that's done. The other way is to maybe add some food. So a bacterial food would be sugar, for instance. Put some sugar out, spray it out, and you get a bacterial bloom in your pasture, and then your protozoa numbers will breed up to eat the fact that they've got a good supply of food. So there's several ways of doing it. So to explain a protozoa spray, it's a bit like Irish water. How do you make Irish water? You put water in a glass and stir. So it's pretty simple. Basically, really need to be using probably organically grown lucerne is probably really the best way of doing it. Maybe just a biscuit off a small bale of hay. Put it into some unchlorinated water. So doesn't have to be distilled water, but fairly clean water, and then bubble it maybe 24 hours, and this is where a microscope is handy. You can check it under the microscope, look at protozoa numbers. Now, if that lucerne hasn't had any chemicals on it, we would expect there to be reasonable protozoa in spore form on the lucerne. I think they pick up some dissolved nutrients out of the lucerne as well, which they can live on. So there's a bit of a bacteria grows in the water. The protozoan numbers breed up. In about 24 hours, you'd expect the protozoan numbers to be up high enough to become a protozoa spray. So that's something that some farmers are doing.
It's fantastic. Now, Tony, back to the actual difference of using liquid nitrogen over time, I'd just like to know about your cost factor, whether it's cheaper to start with or if it's more expensive and, you're using less and less over time. Can you just comment on that, please?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. When we go into a farm as an introduction, it's the first time on the farm, we usually say to them, whatever your nitrogen budget is, keep it the same. We're not going to change your budget. We're just going to change the way that we do it. So we look at their fertiliser budget, and there's a portion of the budget we are going to change dramatically, and that is we're going to say to them, let's cut back your P and K and put it into the compost and make it available, and we'll play with the numbers there a bit, but the nitrogen budget will stay the same. So by going from a granular to a liquid, they will reduce the amount of it's more cost effective, so they will reduce their cost that way. But a lot of guys aren't necessarily geared up to do that because they haven't got a boom spray, or it's a different contractor who's not prepared to come in on small acreage. There's usually a few other variables there which invariably actually can cost a little bit more.
Yeah.
So their budget doesn't seem to change that much in the first couple of years. So, yes, there's a bit of a saving in the nitrogen side of it, but depending on the farm, it isn't necessarily a saving in the whole budget. It's just spent differently. So,
you're saying that you won't spend more. That, that's a great comfort for a farmer to know that he's going to get that change over time, but you're respecting the fact that he has got a budget. That's great.
Yes, he's got a budget, that's right, and we're going to get him to spend it differently, but I don't see any saving in his first couple of years on his nitrogen budget. What will happen over after the first year or second year, he'll either make a decision to buy his own boom spray, and then he can start to play. And it might be a small boom spray behind the four-wheel motorbike, and he follows the cows around and does each paddock as he takes the cows out. It might be as simple as that. So there's no contractor, there's no big input costs as in labour, and he just decants a bit out of a tank each night or each morning, whatever, and he sprays behind the cows as they come out of the paddock, and then that paddock's ready when it's back in the rotation in 30 or 40 days' time. So what will happen is after 12 months or 2 years, the farm will start to work through that nitrogen budget, and we encourage him to do things slightly differently, and he'll look at that, and eventually what will happen is, one, he's the amount of N that he uses on the farm is reduced, and he'll then work through the system, and he'll start to get some cost savings on the system that he's using as well.
Yeah, that's great. And you're indicating there is a withholding period as well, like with the product?
With the liquid nitrogen, you've really got to go by the manufacturer's recommendations, but generally speaking, most farmers will follow the cows around with their liquid nitrogen, depending on their farming practices. In that case, generally speaking, the cows aren't back in that paddock for, depending on the rotation, somewhere between 30 and 40 days. So I'm not sure what the withholding period is on the nitrogen is, and it probably does vary from farm to farm. I suppose most farmers just have to be aware of nitrate poisoning, so that comes back to how they normally manage their nitrogen and their cow's diet, really.
Yeah, and that's what happens with those, rapid spring growth, isn't it? Look, I think that's great. Is there anything else you want to say before we move on to looking at other ways that you can suffer the effect of chemicals on a farm? Or we've gone to weeds?
Yeah, well, I suppose as part of the program, if we go back to where we started, when we look at compost, we like to incorporate it into a program. So part of that program is moving from a granular nitrogen to a liquid nitrogen. So we've minimised the damage to the soil from a nitrogen point of view. But the other part of the program is moving away from water-soluble fertilisers being applied to the farm directly. So if the farm does need P or K or any trace elements, then incorporate it into compost, whether it's your own compost or bought compost, whether it's our compost or someone else's compost, it doesn't matter. But the concept of putting into the compost, and several things happen. One is you don't need the same volume because, generally speaking, let's say the farmer puts out 100 kilos of pea as an example to the hectare. That's what he would do in the conventional system. Let's say 90% of it ties up. So with pea, it ties up with calcium or aluminium or iron or whatever else it can tie up with. And you use about 10% of it. If you put the phosphorus, and we usually look at either a soft rock phosphate or a reactive rock phosphate or maybe a chook manure, which is reasonable for phosphorus, into the compost, what happens is it ties up with the organic matter rather than the minerals. And therefore, it's a lot more stable, but it's still available. So what we're doing is we're taking a mineral product and we're asking the bugs to eat it, or we're asking it to be attached to the organic matter. When we put it out as a water-soluble fertilizer, we're putting it in a mineral form. So it actually attaches to the minerals in the soil. It can attach to your clay particle. There's other things it can attach to. It can even attach to the organic matter in your soil. But a large percentage of it is tying up with your minerals because it's in a mineral form. So the idea is to try and tie up the organic matter. So by doing that, suddenly we're not putting water-soluble fertilizers out onto the soil. We're actually putting them into the compost. Might compromise the compost a little bit for a period of time, but it has the ability to recover from that. And then we're putting that material out onto the soil. So we've used the compost as a buffer. And we've actually put the nutrients out in a form where they're stable and available. So what happens is, suddenly we're not using a liquid nitrogen. We've moved away from using chemical fertilizers on the farm. We've put them into the compost and put it out as a buffer and tied up the organic matter. What actually happens, it might take a couple of years, but we then start to see that the microflora in the soil starts to change because we haven't compromised it. And then what happens is we start to get more nutrient cycling. And that can be either through your protozoa and different bugs eating bugs, or it can be an increase in fungal biomass. And once that starts to happen, look out, because what will happen then is maybe the mycorrhizal fungi will start to move back in. And that is a real key for nutrient cycling and nutrient solubility. And it seems to be flavour of the month at the moment, VAM, or mycorrhizal fungi. Yeah, so if we can start getting that, then we reduce the volume, again, of how much nutrient we actually need to put into the system as well. And a lot of other things happen. We start getting root depth because we're opening up the soil profile because we've got fungi growing and opening up the soil with its hyphae. And we're accessing nutrients further down. Another thing that happens, which I only learnt recently, is that as you get mycorrhizal fungi growing around the roots of the plant, the mycorrhizal fungi can help with capillary action and brings moisture back to the root and can reduce, just by getting mycorrhizal fungi in there, you can actually reduce the amount of water or moisture required to grow that plant because it assists with capillary action of bringing the moisture to the root. So there's a lot of benefits that can cut back irrigation rates that are needed. It can make a plant, can be the difference between growing or filling a seed in a cereal crop and not filling it if you can get that extra little bit of moisture in just to tip the grain over and make it a better crop than what it was. There's a lot of benefits there. In the case of the Whiting's farm where we had a field day recently, there was a difference between the cows pulling the grass out by the roots and not. And that was a big difference. So it just depends on what the drivers are, but there's some big changes can start to happen in time. We just have to have patience, and we have to start just changing the way we do things. So so the program, a typical program on a dairy farm, for instance, would be put out your compost, maybe 3 tonnes a hectare if you can afford it, but certainly at lower rates if not. Go to a liquid nitrogen and manage your nitrogen budget that way. Maybe look at a fish and compost tea spray in the spring. That way you're getting on any micronutrients you need for half your growing season with the fish. It's a second go at your paddock with compost teas to complement the compost in the autumn. And also it's putting out some foods as well. And that's sort of the approach that we've been using on farms. It varies slightly depending on, you know, soil types, things like that. Any nutrient the farm needs, as in P, K or calcium or any traces, goes into the compost. So we're still managing that with soil tests as well as soil food web tests or any other tests that that farmers want to use.